All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a chilly 21 degrees with a real feel of 5 and snowing lightly here in upstate New York. Actually, it was close to 50 the last couple days, and the temperature dropped again last night. So where do we leave off? Yesterday, I aired a rebroad, but something that I thought was important that I'd like to continue talking about today was a talk given by Dr. Sam Harris on the coming of artificial general intelligence, or as he called it, superintelligence, and some of the ethics and dangers of technology moving at the pace it is. One of the things that he clearly pointed out, and I thought it was interesting because he is a neuroscientist who is also an ethicist, and he ponders all kinds of ideas. And one of the things that he brought up is that our current trajectory with the development of technology and artificial intelligence, unless we have some sort of global calamity, and he even mentioned pandemics, and we had talked about that the day before, or an asteroid or a nuclear war or something of that nature, unless something that catastrophic happens, because of the value of technological innovation to our global economy and he who gets the most toys wins, world domination, because of the value of increasing our ability to automate, to database, and to come up with thinking machines, unless we have some massive disaster, that's not going to stop. And even if it just happens in baby steps, he said, you know, the quotient of time really is something that you shouldn't even be looking at, because it's inevitable regardless. Even if we just make little baby steps, if it's not 10, 20, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, it's going to happen eventually. So how are they going to do that? We have looked a lot at this intersection between neuroscience and artificial intelligence and this whole brain initiative is inked by the Obama administration, you know, to, of course, cure all disease and to fix your mental health problems. Well, one of the things I ran across the other day that we didn't find a place to fit in here, so we're going to start here today. Neuroscientists have managed to follow a thought. Remember, they can read dreams and do all kinds of things. They've managed to follow a thought as it moves through a human brain. Well, we didn't think that this was possible, but a study using epilepsy patients undergoing surgery has given neuroscientists an opportunity to track in unprecedented detail the movement of a thought through a human brain, all the way from inspiration to response. How frightening is this? The findings confirm the role of the prefrontal cortex. Yeah, that happens to be the area of the brain that gets messed up when you spend too much time on your computer, as the coordinator of complex interactions between different regions, linking our perception with action and serving as what can be considered the quote-unquote glue of cognition. Previous efforts to measure the passing information from one area to another have relied on processes such as EEGs or encephalographies or fMRIs, which are the functional magnetic resonance imaging, which, while non-invasive, offer less perfect resolutions. The study, led by researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, recorded the electrical activity of neurons using a precise technique called electrocorticography, and that is an ECOG. This records hundreds of tiny electrodes to be placed right up against the cortex, so this must have been when they were inside his head, providing more spatial detail than an EEG and improving the resolution in time of an fMRI. While this poses an unethical level of risk for your average volunteer, step right up. Patients undergoing surgery for epilepsy have their brain activity monitored in this very way, giving researchers a perfect chance, wink, to conduct a few tests. Each of the 16 test subjects performed a number of tasks varied to suit their individual arrangement of electrodes, all while having their neural activity monitored and tracked. Participants were required to listen to a stimulus and respond, or watch images of faces or animals on a screen and asked to perform an action. And while some tasks were more complex than others, for example, a simple action involved simply repeating a word, while a more complex version was to think of its antonym, researchers monitored the split-second movement of electrical activity from one area, such as associated with interpreting auditory stimuli, to the prefrontal cortex, to the other areas required to shape an action, such as the motor cortex. While none of this threw up any surprises, the results clearly emphasized the role of the prefrontal cortex in directing activity. You know, what's so horrible about this is that prefrontal cortex is where that dopamine button resides. And as you get addicted to your devices, and children especially that are forced to interact with these devices as part of going to school on a daily basis, those areas of the brain get shaped in a way that they weren't meant to be shaped. And it causes problems with executive function, being able to get from point A to point B and understanding the tasks in between that are like climbing a ladder to get there. So for some tasks, input was fairly limited. And in other areas, there was work required that was hard, managing signals from multiple parts of the brain to coordinate the recognition of words, possibly dredging up memories before settling to work on a bunch of muscles to provide a novel answer. These very selective studies have found that the frontal cortex is actually the orchestrator linking things together for a final output. It is the glue of cognition. The prefrontal cortex was seen to remain active throughout most of the thought process, as would be expected for a multitasking region of the brain, and the quicker the handoff from one area to another, the faster people responded to a stimulus. fMRI studies often find that when a task gets progressively harder, we see more brain activity in the prefrontal cortex in particular. And here we are able to see that this is not because the neurons are working really, really hard and firing all the time, but rather more areas of the cortex are getting recruited. And what did come as a surprise were the details of the precise timing of each area. Some of the responding areas lit up remarkably early, often during the stimulus, suggesting that even before we had complete responses handy, our brain is already getting those parts of the cortex ready for action. This might explain why some people say things before they think. Yeah, I tend to do that sometimes. All right, so don't make me sing. We had over the last couple weeks, the Consumer Electronics Show was going on in Vegas. I don't know if this was from there. For some reason, I thought it was. Talking about EEGs and fMRIs, I have a few stories here. So this EEG headset can tell what music your brain likes. Measuring brain waves is getting easier. And an in-tech headset could improve your memory, change video games while you play, or give you an attitude adjustment. So you don't have to go get your skull cracked. Just put this little headset on. If you have seen an electroencephalogram technology, it probably had something to do with scientists researching brain waves by wiring a bunch of electrodes to somebody's skull. But now European researchers have an easier approach that they think will break the technology out of the laboratory. At the tech show, a showing off of a much simpler EEG headset that'll gauge your emotions. We read about that, emotive, and it can help with therapy, but it can also help you tackle other things like changing a video game as you play, improving your memory while you're learning, matching to your mood, or even adjusting your mood by changing your music. With the integration of musical playback, the system can not only measure, but also influence the emotions of the person that are wearing the headset. The system uses artificial intelligence to instantly identify the wearer's emotional state by looking at your brainwaves. And emotions are increasingly quantified in the digital era. Analytics tools can analytics tools can that Twitter and Facebook users have toward products, voice assessment software that can route you to a different customer service rep depending on whether you're relaxed or you're angry. And it may sound kind of creepy, but it's the sort of thing we do unconsciously all the time when interacting with our fellow humans. Imtech got its start as a consortium to blaze trails in next-generation microprocessor manufacturing, and that is still a core activity at their center in Leuven, Belgium, but they've diversified into other areas, including health technologies. So what do you think about that one? Change your music by reading what your brain is feeling to change your emotions. And if meditation apps don't appeal to you, these brand spanking new brain-reading sunglasses just might. Technology for meditation sounds like a paradox, right? Well, the whole point of meditation, in a sense, is to unplug and get into the woods. And yet, meditation technology has become wildly popular over the past year. Apple picked up the app Calm, which is a mindfulness and meditation app, for its app of the year for 2017, and competitors like Headspace have developed loyal followings. Meditation has never been easy for me, but I've been trying it for years, and that's not me, that's the author, and in no small part to get away from the constant distraction of technology. I'm particularly hooked on the social media and the workflow apps that my phone has made all too convenient, and so the idea of using a smartphone and a pair of earbuds to clear my mind has always seemed too counterintuitive to even try it. But the meditation technology that I, the author, encountered at this year's Consumer Electronics Show, which is the largest consumer electronics show in the world, really surprised me. These weren't your typical apps, which have a supposedly soothing whisper voice in your ear to encourage you to chill out. But rather, I found a pair of brain-reading sunglasses, the Lowdown Focus Glasses by Smith Optics. These shades actually have EEG sensors in the bridge of the nose and behind the ears that read your brainwaves, and a sunglass pair with a smartphone app that you will use with a pair of headphones. Put the sunglasses on so they touch your skin and start the session on the app, and then sit quietly. And as your brain starts to become more active, you begin to hear a very basic, non-annoying ocean wave. And the more distracted you are, the louder the wave sound becomes. And it worked, drowning out my thoughts and allowing me to realize my mind was drifting into things that I need not think about. The beauty of this technology was that it wasn't telling me to chill out, which I could find patronizing and obnoxious, and I think I would too. The wave brought me a chill space, a quiet mind, and my brain activity began to reduce. So did the volume of the wave sound, my calmness rewarded with silence. Afterward, the app showed me a chart indicating how much I was able to relax my mind, and I feel confident that if I tried again tomorrow, I would be able to even relax more, and the app also has guided meditation options with an area of focus for people who want to do targeted cognitive training, for instance, to improve sleep or relaxation or the general ability to improve your focus. So if you're like me and too cool to meditate with just a smartphone app, then a pair of brain-reading sunglasses could actually help. At the very least, it is better than some of the creepy digital whispers. And what do you think about that? Now, why are they putting stuff like this out? Well, they're reading this information. Remember, they may not be connected to the Internet of Things today, but they will sure be tomorrow. And these early adopter technologies are things that are just getting us used to this type of stuff. But they are going to give it to you as part of your future medical intervention. Because listen to this new story. Retirement. And don't think you're ever going to retire, but you might sooner rather than later when the robots come take all the jobs. Retirement causes brain function to rapidly decline, warned scientists, January 22nd, 2018. Workers looking forward to enjoying a long and leisurely retirement after years of toil may need to think again. New research shows that brain function declines rapidly as soon as people stop working and put their feet up. A major British study which tracked 3,400 retired civil servants found that short-term memory declines nearly 40% faster once employees become pensioners. It appears that the lack of regular stimulation takes a heavy toll on cognitive function and speeds up memory loss and dementia, researchers warn. That's why you have to become a researcher. Professor Carrie Cooper, an expert in organizational psychology at Manchester Business School, said that the study confirmed previous research suggesting if people don't use it, they lose it. And I have said that so many times before. It makes more likely that dementia will set in earlier. We know more cognitively active you are, the more it offsets the risk of dementia. And I'm not talking about doing Sudoku or doing something completely different from your job. So if you worked in civil service all your life, why not go and help out in a hospital or teach? The most important thing is to interact with people. And even high-ranking civil servants with mentally demanding jobs saw brain capacity plummet once they quit, the study found. And it suggests that a busy and high-flying career offers no protection against cognitive decline unless pensioners keep physically and mentally active. About 850,000 people in Britain currently have Alzheimer's disease or dementia. And remember, it's an epidemic here in the United States. So step right up for your brain scan. And with an aging population, this figure is forecast to reach 1 million by 2025 and 2 million by 2050. And what do you think that those people are going to rate on the scale of being useful to society when they're looking to take the carbon quotient down to zero? Not only do we have this epidemic of dementia and Alzheimer's disease, but we've talked about malformed prions before, brain wasting diseases, and they don't just occur in humans with that Jacobs-Jacobs disease or whatever it is, and then the different variants, but they also occur in other animals such as deer. Learned across this yesterday. Researchers have been worried for a while because I covered this a long time ago, but this is a news story from one day ago out of MSN. Researchers are worried that brain illnesses, such as those known as zombie deer disease, may start infecting humans. Uh-oh, another pandemic, and one that eats your brain. Now, if anyone listened to Clint Richardson's show, he and Patrick were on this past Sunday. It was number 18. It's in the archives, and they talked a lot about a show called Brain Dead on, I don't know what it was, on Amazon, I think, or Netflix. And it was about these brain-eating outer space parasites that were eating the brains of the D.C. politicians and making them argumentative and taking over the personalities. And, well, you know, in all honesty, the show was kind of a dark comedy, but it actually really isn't that far of a stretch. We already know about things such as toxoplasmosis. We've talked about that before. That is that parasite that comes from cat fecal matter. So anybody's had kitty cats all their lives and has clean litter boxes are at risk for possibly having some sort of infection with this parasite. But it gets into your brain and it actually changes your personality. They have seen it in mice, and when mice get infected with toxoplasmosis, it actually gives them what they call kitty goggles. And it makes the mice not afraid of the cat, and it makes the mouse a very easy target for kitty cat food because they don't run away when they smell cat pee, which is a typical warning sign to any type of you have a predator and then you have the one who's being predatored to be eaten. It's one telltale sign that you better run, little mousey, you better run. But they aren't afraid when they smell the cat urine. So anyway, another brain affecting disease is the zombie disease. Again, they call it the chronic wasting disease, or in humans, like I said, is CJD, CJVD. And in cows, it is the bovine, I don't remember. It's called BV. Hold on. Senior moment. It's mad cow disease, but it's called the bovine something encephalopathy. I don't remember. I used to know it. When a deer gets infected with chronic wasting disease, it's before the signs of illness become visible. And at some point, the animals start to lose weight, stop interacting with other deer, and then lose its fear of humans. as well as may start drinking or salivating more. And ultimately, it winds up staring vacantly as it starves to death. And this illness is called the zombie deer disease. A disease similar to mad cow disease and is caused by the spread of misfolded proteins called prions. We've talked about those as well. And as far as we know, no humans have ever been infected with the chronic wasting disease, or so they say, wink. But Canadian researchers are concerned that this disease could potentially start to infect humans that eat deer, elk, moose, and other members of the same animal family that carry the proteins. Preliminary results from an ongoing study at the Health Products and Food Branch of the Health Canada shows that mox, which are the little mock monkeys, primates most similar to humans that can be used in research, can catch CWD, or chronic wasting disease, after regularly consuming infected meat. Because of that, the potential for the chronic wasting disease to be transmitted to humans cannot be excluded. And I said this long ago, guys, there's so many things. They said, oh, don't worry about the mad cow disease because humans can't get it. And remember, they had just one test case and whoops, it totally affected the potentiality of beef sales from the United States. And at the time, all the beef farmers were friends of, at that time, President George Bush Jr. And so they said, don't worry about it. We don't have any more infected cows out there. Just keep eating your beef. I stopped eating it for a really long time after that. And the most prudent approach is to consider the chronic wasting disease as a potential to infect humans. Researchers first noticed the disease about 50 years ago in Colorado, which I thought was interesting as well. Another one of those mad science government centers where things happen down long, dark hallways that you don't quite know about. Since then, it has began spreading to neighboring states as well as Canada and several states along the Great Lakes, which is around this area, including Wisconsin and Michigan. Prion illnesses are caused by the spread of misfolded proteins that cause other proteins to deform. They are often progressively fatal, and scientists think that they have the ability to adapt to infect different types of species, including potentially ourselves. But such an illness is not well understood. It is similar to mad cow, and it became a problem after cattle ate bone meal from sheep with a neurodegenerative disease. Once this illness made its way into the human food supply, it eventually caused a new type of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, like I said, which causes rapid brain deterioration in people. Immunologist Mark Zabel of Colorado State University said that because of the chronic wasting disease is still a newly discovered condition, it may evolve rapidly, which leads us to believe it is only a matter of time before prions emerge that can spread to humans and eat part of your brain. But for now, the hunters who harvest deer and elk in affected areas get samples of their kill tested before grilling up any venison steak. And if the test comes back positive, they recommend discarding the meat. So look out, people, because yes, they are coming after your brain. Can machine learning from an fMRI be a computer-aided diagnostic tool for future brain diseases? Well, let's do an fMRI and see what we can find out. Recent statistics have shown about half the population in the U.S. suffers from at least one type of health problem, including a mental illness, substance use disorder, or a chronic mental condition. Substance use and mental disorders are both considered brain diseases. Brain disorders are a major worldwide problem, so we're going to have to fix it. It's also pointed out in studies analyzing data from the World Health Global Survey, and a better understanding of these diseases includes techniques for diagnostics and for treatments that are needed to impact and improve the global life expectancy. Intensive research has been performed to study Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's disease, schizophrenia, Huntington's disease, and addiction. And research suggests that brain diseases change both brain wiring and brain function. Brain connections can not only be damaged, but they can also be rewired as a compensatory mechanism. So the fact that some humans can live with only about half of their brain provides a good example of this adaptability. And there's a great interest in disease-related changes. The configuration of brain connectivity is a potential to be an indicator or a biomarker for the existence of brain disease or the prediction of future outcomes. Ding, ding, ding. Predictive mental medicine. Functional brain connectivity during the resting state. One way of measuring brain function is to use non-invasive methods such as MRI or EEG to observe the brain while a human individual performs an activity such what as meditation, like we were just seeing. Yeah, I think they do collect that data. It's probably terms and conditions of utilizing some of those products. That is to get a baseline on your mental activity. And this procedure is not only... It's not always convenient in the context of biomarker discovery. One example is the ability of humans to learn and improve task performance, which could interfere with diagnosis. There is also the difficulty for certain patients to perform tasks, and for these reasons, observing the brain at rest without intervention of a particular task is a promising approach for individual subject prediction, which does not require individuals to perform a task. So during the resting state data experiment, a person is requested to rest without performing any particular course of action. No particular consensus is yet adopted to determine whether the eyes should be left open or closed. However, open eyes might help to reduce the possibility of sleeping. And in many cases, a slight fixation item is used to aid the scanned person. In some cases, eyes are monitored by staff outside of the scanner. Though the analysis of collected data in a resting state of brain connectivity pattern emerges, and at this point, we can use analysis approaches to identify patterns in brain activity that show activity consistent with a healthy brain or abnormal deviations from a healthy connectivity pattern that can indicate a presence of brain disease. Yes, operating outside of parameters. Two brain regions can be connected in various ways. And anatomically, two regions can be linked by the physical extension of neurons called axons. Two brain regions can also show statistical similarity that shows a functional connection. These connections are not necessarily active all the time. For example, closing our eyes when trying to remember could be a way of redirecting the brain areas in charge of visual processing to aid by using visual memory images, which I think actually works. In this context, if two brain areas are active at the same time, there's a type of connectivity due to common function. We found out in an earlier story that the prefrontal cortex, when it is trying to process some sort of action, engages other parts of the brain to help it in its quest. So now a story we read probably a couple weeks ago, naughty or nice, one brain scan is now all it takes to find out. So let's keep putting ourselves into these machines and let them get a database full of our brain scans. With a simple scan of your brain at rest, some scientists can now guess whether, on an average, you are naughty or nice. This will be great for the predictive policing. We've now begun to see really strong evidence of a connection between measures of brain function, connectivity, and many aspects of people's lives and personality, says lead author Dr. Stephen Smith, a biomedical engineer at the University of Oxford. The surprisingly strong correlations published last week in Nature Neuroscience are the first to emerge from the ambitious Human Connectome Project, a global effort that seeks to map all of the pathways between the brain's hundreds of regions and millions of neurons and then relate those connectivity patterns to personality and behavior. So stated Sebastian Sung, in a computational neuroscientist at MIT, in a 2010 TED Talk that propelled the nascent field of connectomics into the public limelight. In that one sentence, "I am my connectome," Sung touched on two provocative ideas. One was philosophical, that people's identity, our personality, our habits, our lifestyles, our memories, and our experience are stored in functional connections in our brain, disrupt the connectome in cases such as schizophrenia, and we lose our core identity. The other idea was more of a scientific prophecy. By advancing brain imaging technologies, we may be able to map out the wiring of our brains in unprecedented detail. similar to geographic maps, which allowed explorers to venture onto the edges of the world. A brain atlas may push the frontier of neuroscience forward by offering an in-depth visualization of the inner workings of our minds. And the days of just looking at one part of the brain are waning, says Dr. Arthur Toga of the University of Southern California, launched 6 years ago with an initial funding of $40 million. The Human Connectome Project is scanning the brains of 1,200 adults with an fMRI, and a major branch of the project focuses on the brain at rest, and that is when you are not concentrating on a specific task, but rather allowing it to wander. These resting state connectomes, so get your brain wandering sunglasses, are thought to reflect on how different areas of the brain are hooked up in a locked and loaded state, and in case of a sudden future task, requires them to efficiently fire together. But there is more. Each brain scan is linked to reams of demographic and personality data summarized by hundreds of different traits. And these range from objective measures such as IQ test scores, attention span, and socioeconomic status to self-reported factors like life satisfaction, personality, and whether they had used drugs or shown a physical aggression in the past. There is a treasure trove ripe for data mining, so put it on the blockchain, and Smith and his team have dug deep. The team wasn't simply interested in relating one personality or success factor from another. From the onset, explained Smith, we wanted to use a single integrated analysis to see whether specific brain connectivity patterns are associated with specific sets of correlated traits, either good or bad. The team took the data from 461 scans and ran a massive computer program to create an average map of the brain's resting state across 200 different regions. And then in every participant, the scientists looked at how much of those regions talk to each other, effectively charting out where the strongest links lie and what strengths of those connections are. Finally, in a computational tour de force, the team added 280 traits to the pool of brain scan data, and for each participant performed canonical correlation analysis, which is a type of statistical wizardry that helps unearth relationships between data sets with hundreds of complex variables. The result was stark and stunning. The brain connectivity patterns could be aligned in a single axis, where one end was associated with positive traits such as education, better memory, and physical performance, and where the other were negative ones such as rule breaking and poor sleep quality. Positive people on the positive side of the axis also had stronger connectivity between brain networks associated with higher cognitive functions, including memory, language, introspection, and imagination. It is incredibly impressive, says Dr. Marcus Richel, a neuroscientist at Washington University, that scans of the brain at rest were sufficient to condense vastly variable life experiences into a one single simple axis. And with one scan, you can distinguish people with successful traits leading successful lives versus those who don't, he says. Now, think about that one for a moment. So as this consumer technology is coming out that is doing brain reading and taking your brain to a resting state where they can look at all these other areas of the brain and draw conclusions about the type of person that you are, where is that data going? Obviously, for each person, there's going to be an error bar in guessing who they are as a person just by looking at the brain connectivity, but an overall association is very strong. The study begs the obvious question, which way does the influence go? Are brain wiring patterns leading us to success or failure in life, or are our life experiences shaping the connections in our brains? And I would go with the latter. And for now, Smith says, we don't actually know the answer, and it is very likely that the connection of causality goes both ways. To test causality, we would need intervention studies that impose positive traits, say enforced education, to see whether that imprints a good connectome on the brain. That's in the future, ding ding. But for now, we can look for traits that correlate with positive brain connections and then tweak them in a way that pulls the brain toward the positive ends of the axis. Marijuana use in recent weeks, for example, was one of the factors that drove a brain more towards the bad end of the axis. That's hysterical. This suggests that pot is a negative trait that should be prioritized for further study. But scientists caution that good and bad are relative, and I have said that before. It must be placed in a social context, and that is fair to consider marijuana for medical reasons as negative. A person's placement on the positive-negative scale also isn't a proxy for general intelligence. For example, people with good hand-eye coordination tend to slide toward the bad side of the axis. So that would be your artists and anyone who can do multitask things. Or play an instrument. So there is much that we still need to sort out, says Van Weeden, a neuroscientist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and they also are in cahoots with MIT. There's also a taste of what is to come with the Human Connectome Project in full swing. It is likely that the further deluge of data, that is how we develop as kids, how our brains age in health and disease, will provoke more questions than it answers, but it is a good place to start. So step right up for your brain scan, because they'll be able to tell all kinds of things about you. So Stanford now steps right up. The scientists at Stanford have invented an artificial intelligence that can predict your death with up to a 90% accuracy. January 22nd, 2018. Humans today live a lot longer than they used to, but that is the great news. But as modern medicine is advancing, they are giving patients second chances at living normal lives. End of care continues to be a difficult thing to plan. Forecasting when someone will die is an extremely challenging and often uncomfortable thing. But Stanford researchers have trained in artificial intelligence to be able to predict death with incredible accuracy, and it could revolutionize end of care for patients who are reaching their ends. So make sure you don't get in line for the death panel. The goal is to better match patients and family wishes with an accurate timeline of individuals' final months, weeks, and even days while affording them the opportunity to plan ahead for the inevitable. The work is titled Improving Palliative Care with Deep Learning, and it is currently available online. Improving the quality of end-of-life care for hospitalized patients is a priority for healthcare organizations, and I wonder if it is for insurance companies as well, the researchers wrote. To be able to give the projections for next year, studies have shown that physicians tend to overestimate prognoses, which in combination with treatment inertial results in a mismatch between patients' wishes and actual care at the end of life. Inaccurate predictions from doctors can create unwanted consequences, such as patients spending their final days in a hospital ward rather than at home surrounded by their loved ones. By removing the human predictive element from the equation, which may be influenced by emotion and optimism, the algorithm gets rid of all emotion and it takes a calculated look at the data and makes a call based on just facts. The result is a much more accurate prediction of death that allows the patient and the family to plan for the best, most comfortable send-off. The algorithm the research developed has been trained with over 2 million patient records, and using the data that the AI can spot patterns that are simply invisible to a single doctor. By drawing from those patterns, it can make an educated guess as to when an ill patient will ultimately pass. And when the algorithm is used to predict the passing of a patient who is in palliative care, meaning they are not expected to live more than 12 months, the system forecasts death with an astonishing 90% accuracy. The way the AI goes about its prediction is quite complex, and while the researchers know how the system digests the data is being fed, the algorithm doesn't have a simple way of explaining how it reached its conclusions. Despite that, the digital brain is accurate enough in its predictions that the how is a secondary concern. And that's what we got to be careful of. That's one of the things that they had talked about a while ago, where DARPA was working and trying to create some sort of artificial intelligence that can explain how it came to its conclusions. So now let's take another step forward. As they are working on finding the connectomes in human brains and scanning 2 million different patients for all of their biostatistics to determine with 90% accuracy how long they're going to live, we also have a neuroscientist named Randall Cohn, and he is recruiting top neuroscientists to help him make humans live forever. The neuroscientist who wants to upload humanity to a computer, and I don't remember if we ever got into this one or not, but we're going to take it here. Everything felt possible at a Transhuman Vision 2014 conference held back in February of 2014, billed as a forum for visionaries to describe our fast approaching, brilliant and bizarre future to never die. Inside of an old waterfront military depot in San Francisco's Fort Mason Center, young entrepreneurs hawked experimental smart drugs and coffee made with a special kind of butter that they said provided cognitive enhancements. A woman offered an online therapy session, and a middle-aged conventioneer wore an electrode array that displayed his brainwaves on a monitor as a multicolored pattern. On stage, a speaker with a shaved head and a thick black beard held forth a DIY sensory augmentation device, and a group called Science for the Masses was developing a pill that would soon allow humans to perceive a near-infrared spectrum. Step right up for that one. He personally had implanted tiny magnets into his outer ear so he could listen to music converted into vibrations by a magnetic coil attached to his phone. None of this seemed particularly ambitious, however, compared with the claim soon to follow. In the back of the audience, carefully reviewing his notes, sat Randall Cohn, a bespectacled neuroscientist wearing black cargo pants, a black t-shirt showing a brain on a laptop, and I think we did read this, and a pair of black shiny boots. And Cohn had come to explain to the assembled crowd how to live forever. Quote, "As a species, we only inhabit a small sliver of time and space," says Cohn when he took the stage. "We want to be a species that can be effective and influential and creative in a much larger sphere." Cohn's solution was straightforward. He planned to upload his brain to a computer, and by mapping the brain, reducing its activity to computations, and then reproducing those computations in code, Cohn argued that humans could live indefinitely emulated by silicon. When I say emulation, you should think of it, for example, in the same sense as emulating a Macintosh on a PC, says. It is kind of like a platform-independent code, and the audience sat silent, possibly awed, possibly confused, as Cohn led them through a complex tour of recent advances in neuroscience, supplemented with charts and graphs. And Cohn has always had a complicated relationship with transhumanists, who likewise believe in elevating humanity to another plane. A Dutch-born neuroscientist and neuroengineer, Cohn has spent several decades collecting the credentials necessary to bring his fringe ideas in line with the mainstream science, and now that science is coming to him. Researchers around the globe have made deciphering the brain their central objective. Ding, ding. And in 2013, both the U.S. and the EU announced initiatives that promised to accelerate brain research in much the same way that the Human Genome Project advanced genomics. The minutiae may have been lost on the crowd, but Cohn departed the stage. The significance of what they just witnessed was not the knowledge necessary to achieve what Cohn calls, quote, substrate independent minds seem tantalizingly within reach. The concept of brain emulations has a long, colorful history in science fiction, but it is also deeply rooted in computer science. And an entire field known as neural networking is based on the physical architecture and the biological rules that underpin neuroscience. Roughly 85 billion neurons make up the human brain, each one connected to as many as 10,000 others via branches called axons and dendrites. And every time a neuron fires, an electrochemical signal jumps from one axon of a neuron to the dendrite of another and across the synapse between them. It is the sum of those signals that encode information and enable the brain to process input, form associations, and execute their commands. Many neuroscientists believe that the essence of who we are, our memories, emotions, personalities, predilections, and even our consciousnesses lie in those patterns. Well, the reason why I bring this up is because I want to give you a reminder. There is a workshop January 28th, 2018, that is this Sunday coming up, that is being live streamed at carboncopies.org, titled Transcending Biology, Reverse Engineering the Brain. It starts at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, which is 8, 9, 10, 11. Eastern Time, and it goes until 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Transcending Biology, Reverse Engineering This Brain. On Sunday, January 28th, Carbon Copies is hosting a public workshop on whole brain emulation and mind uploading. Attendance online or in person is free of charge, and the workshop is designed to both introduce whole brain emulation and the Carbon Copies organization, as well as provide an update of current status and activities. The workshop will emphasize participation through Q&A and topical discussion, and it includes a bunch of different topics. I think you guys should attend this if you get a chance. I'm not going to be around for a good part of the afternoon on the 28th, but I definitely want to watch a replay. They also are going to talk about Kernel in Neuralink. Kernel is where Cone is affiliated with, and that is one of those little brain implants. So that might be kind of interesting, and the link to this will be in the notes to the show today. All right, so another one, brand new story from this morning. MIT engineers have designed a chip that behaves just like brain cell connections. This is the most promising artificial synapse to date. January 24, 2018, out of sciencealert.com. For those working in the field of advanced artificial intelligence, getting a computer to simulate brain activity is a gargantuan task, but it may be easier to manage if the hardware is designed more like brain hardware to start with. This emerging field is called neuromorphic computing, and now engineers at MIT have overcome a significant hurdle, and that is the design of a chip with an artificial synapse. For now, human brains are much more powerful than any computer, as they contain around 80 billion neurons and over 100 trillion synapses connected to them and controlling their passage of signals. But how a computer chip currently works is by transmitting signals in a language called binary, and every piece of information is encoded in zeros and ones, or on and off signals. To get an idea of how this compares to a brain, consider this. In 2013, one of the world's most powerful supercomputers ran a simulation of brain activity, achieving only minuscule results. And Riken's K computer used 82,944 processors and a petabyte of main memory, which is the equivalent of around 250,000 desktop computers at one time. It took 40 minutes to simulate 1 second of the activity in 1.73 billion neurons connected to 10.4 trillion synapses in a brain. And that may sound like a lot, but it is really equivalent to just 1% of the human brain. But if a chip uses synapse-like connections, the signals used by a computer could be much more varied, enabling synapse-like learning. So synapses mediate the signals transmitted through the brain, and the neurons activate depending on the number and the types of ions flowing across the synapse. We've talked about those calcium ion channels before. This helps the brain recognize patterns, remember facts, or carry out tasks, or also flip neuronal switches on and off. We talked about. And replicating this has been proven difficult to date, but researchers at MIT have now designed a chip with artificial synapses made of silicon germanium that allow the precise control of the strength of electrical current flowing along them, just like ion flow between neurons. And I've run across that silicon germanium before. One of the things that I remember is some sort of growth in the silicon germanium, where they almost grow like neuromorphic tendrils in brain tissue. In a simulation, it was used to recognize handwriting samples with a 95% accuracy. Previous designs for neuromorphic chips used two conductive layers separated by an amorphous switching medium to act like synapses, and when switched on, ions flow through the medium to create a conductive filaments that mimic synaptic weight or strength or weaknesses of signals between two neurons. And the problem with this approach is that without defined structures to travel along, the signals have an infinite number of paths, and this can make the chip's performance inconsistent or unpredictable. But once you apply a voltage which represents some data to your artificial neuron, you have to erase and be able to write again in the exact same way. But in an amorphous solid, when you write again, the ions go in different directions because there are lots of defects. The stream is changing, and it is hard to control, and that is our biggest problem, non-uniformity of the artificial synapse. But with this in mind, the team created lattices of silicon germanium and with one-dimensional channels through which the ions can flow. This ensures the exact same path is used every single time. And when these lattices, just like crystalline lattices, were then used to build a neuromorphic chip, that is when the voltage was applied and all the synapses on the chip showed the exact same current with a variation of only 4%. And a single synapse was also tested with voltages applied 700 times. Its current was varied by just 1%. The most uniform device was possible. The team tested the chip on an actual task by simulating its characteristics. And using those with the MNIST database of handwriting samples, usually used for training image processing software. And I would imagine something like that would be for banks for verifying signatures. Their simulated artificial network, which consisted of three neural sheets separated by two layers of artificial synapses, was able to recognize tens of thousands of handwritten numerals with 95% accuracy compared to the 97% accuracy of existing software. The actual next step is to build a chip that is capable of carrying out handwriting recognition tasks with the end goal of creating portable neural network devices. Ultimately, we want a chip as big as a fingernail to replace one big supercomputer, says Kim. And this research opens a stepping stone to produce real artificial intelligence hardware, in the size of a fingernail. So machines teaching each other could be the biggest exponential trend in artificial intelligence. January 21st, 2018. It is easier to communicate the faster the change happens, says James Burke. During an October 2015 press conference announcing the autopilot feature of the Tesla Model S, which allowed the car to drive semi-autonomously, Tesla CEO Elon Musk said that each driver would become an expert trainer for every Model S car. Each car could improve its own autonomous features by learning from its driver. And remember, that's how this technology is working. Anything that is being fed into the machine, whether it's from your meditation sunglasses or interacting with a self-driving vehicle, you are teaching the machine how to get better every single time you interact with it. That knowledge could then be shared after it learns from its own driver with other Tesla vehicles. And there was that learning in the cloud stuff we had talked about quite a while ago. As Fred Lambert with Electric reported shortly after, Model S owners noticed how quickly the car's driverless features were improving. In one example, Teslas were taking incorrect exits along a highway, forcing the owners to steer manually along the correct route. And after a few weeks, owners noted that the cars were no longer taking premature exits. I find it remarkable that it is improving so rapidly, says one Tesla owner. Intelligent systems like those powered by the latest round of machine learning software aren't just getting smarter, they are getting smarter faster. And understanding the rate at which these systems develop can be a particularly challenging part of navigating technological change. Ray Kurzweil, they have to invoke him, has written extensively on the gaps in human understanding between what he calls the intuitive linear view of technological change and the exponential rate of change and how it is taking place. Almost two decades after writing the influential essay that he calls The Law of Accelerating Returns, a theory of evolutionary change concerned with the speed at which systems improve over time, connected devices are now sharing knowledge between themselves, escalating the speed at which they improve, and once they apply the Internet of Things to the Internet of Everything, and then tie that to the blockchain, we are going to see that exponential curve increase even more. I think that this is perhaps the biggest exponential trend in AI, says Hod Lipson, a professor of mechanical engineering and data science at Columbia University. All of the exponential technology trends have different exponents, says Lipson, but this one is potentially the biggest. According to Lipson, what we might call machine teaching, and that is when devices communicate, gain knowledge to one another, is a radical step up in the speed at which these systems improve. Sometimes it is cooperative, for example, when one machine learns from another like a hive mind, but sometimes it is adversarial, like in an arms race between two systems playing chess against each other. Lipson believes that the way of developing AI is a big deal in part because it can bypass the need for data training. Data is the fuel of machine learning, so keep feeding your data to the machine. But even for machines, some data is hard to get, and it may be risky or slow or rare or expensive. And in those cases, machines can share experiences or create synthetic experiences, like in virtual reality, for each other to augment or replace the data. It turns out that this is not a minor effect, and it actually is self-amplifying and therefore exponential. Lipson sees the recent breakthrough of Google's DeepMind project called AlphaGo Zero as a stunning example of an AI learning without being trained on the data. There are many familiar with AlphaGo, which was the machine learning AI that became the best world Go player. But AlphaGo Zero, however, was able to beat that Go playing AI simply by learning the rules of the game and playing by itself with no training data necessary. Then, just to show off, it beat the world's best chess player software after starting from scratch and trained for just 8 hours. And we found out, Sam Harris mentioned yesterday, that in just a week of training itself, an AI can go through 20,000 years of human learning. So now imagine thousands or more of AlphaGo Zeros instantaneously sharing their gained knowledge across the globe with each other. And this isn't just games, though. Already we are seeing how it will have a major impact at the speed of which businesses can improve their performance of their devices. One example is GE's new digital twin technology, a software simulation of a machine that models what is happening with the equipment. Think of it as a machine with its own self-image, which can also share with technicians. A steam turbine with a digital twin, for instance, can measure steam temperatures, rotor speeds, cold starts, and other data to predict breakdowns and warn technicians to prevent expensive repairs. And the digital twin makes predictions by studying its own performance and creating a virtual copy of itself within the computer virtual reality to be able to model those statistics. How soon is it going to be before it's you, considering that GE has integrated artificial intelligence into its fMRI systems for brain scanning? So anyways, machines begin to learn from their environments in new and powerful ways. Their development is accelerated by communicating what they learn with each other. And this is the collective swarm or hive mind that is coming. Collective intelligence is spreading across the planet, and we can accelerate it or not.